Talk given Sunday, 6th October 1974. It is only in the state of peace and inward poise that we can listen effectively, absorb in the right way what is put before us for our consideration. And if we are in the state of peace and poise, we begin from the end. That is to say, we begin from transcendence itself, the goal, if you like to use that word, or nirvana, or the other shore. The goal, the other shore, the end, is also the source of all things. Between the source and the goal, both of which are eternally here now, the whole of the becoming process takes place. Set in the context of eternity is the process of time. And time means the beginning, which is birth, growth, procedure, experience, trial, tribulation, confusion, struggle, fulfillment, and the end of all things. And all our problems, whether they are personal problems, or whether they are national or world problems, take place in this becoming process in time. The question naturally arises, is it not futile then that the goal should be the same as the source, and there is nothing gained at the end? But the idea of gain is just one of those poisonous darts which prick us all the way through the becoming process. There is a flowering, there is a fulfilling. But that flowering and fulfilling are in reality immeasurable. This is what we constantly forget, that both the source and the goal are the immeasurable, that they cannot have our standards, our conceptions, our doctrines or ideas applied to them. This is where we continuously err. We make a mistake. So we crave for a reward, call it nirvana, kingdom of heaven, peace, well-being, happiness, anything you like. And all those words, whilst they have a very real significance, whilst we are in the becoming process, are quite useless with regard to reality, to the truth, which is religious truth. If our meetings through the years have had any value for us, we should already be more or less conversant with this, at home with this realization, that there is nothing for us as such. The immeasurable contains the measurable, and the measurable is utterly transmuted into that immeasurable. This is the end of the measurable, but it is neither the beginning nor the end of the immeasurable. Now, if we realize that out of our inner being there is called forth an extraordinary strength, the strength of absolute resiliency, the strength which is the power to absorb anything and everything whatsoever. And in that, one's inner poise and peace remain permanent during our lifetime. That is the only permanency possible for us. So you see, if we remain in the state of peace and inwardly poised, and we have the vision that transcendence is the beginning and the end of everything, then we just go on. We just walk on in the right way, without any planning on our part, without any predetermining on our part, what is the right way. This is how we are alive and creatively alive and uniquely and individually alive. Otherwise, our individual uniqueness never comes to any sort of fruition if it is interfered with by the mind which plans. Because the mind which plans and schemes and lays down routes and roads and all the rest of it is the mind which out of its ignorance will inevitably make mistakes. It will inevitably constrict or try to constrict that which is beyond all constriction. That is why we know sorrow and we know death. Death which is merely the ending of things, the breakup, without consummation, without perfection. Without, therefore, the real happiness, which is our fulfillment. Happiness is our birthright. Happiness is constitutive of our being. But we have to just let it be, let it emerge, just as love and wisdom are also constitutive of our being. Now, none of us can deny that we are always concerned with our personal problems. If we do not have problems, in fact, we manufacture them. We are so clever that we are foolish enough to make unnecessary worries rise up before us. This all comes under what the Buddha so rightly called our ignorance, avidya, the unenlightened state, the ignorant state. It is the state in which we stir up everything quite unnecessarily instead of leaving it alone. Consider how when you are walking by the banks of a beautiful stream, and if you have a walking stick or even an umbrella with you, you will often be tempted to stir the water. Quite uselessly. We cannot keep quiet. This is our natural tendency. This is the tyranny of the becoming process working upon us. Now, the same sort of thing happens with regard to the psyche. And let us consider this matter in relation to the psyche, because the psyche is the central feature characterizing the life of human beings. Other animal species also have psyche. A dog, a monkey, an elephant, they all have psyche. Some sort of mental processes, emotional processes. They go on. But we have a psyche which is totally different from the psyche of a cat or a dog or a tiger or a beetle or a wasp or whatever it is. Quite different. It is unique to us. And the psyche is that in us which suffers, which enjoys, which produces problems, which is concerned with their solution, and so forth. No psyche, or if you like to use the other word, mind, no mind, there is no joy, no sorrow, nothing at all. One is just inert to the nth degree. But the moment one has got out of the concretist state of existence, like a stone, for instance, which is the concretist state imaginable, as far as I know anyway, once we have got out of that state, whether it's a plant or an animal or a human, there are indications of what we call the psyche and psychical functioning. Now, we as psychophysical organisms are miniatures of the world organism. We are also ready to talk in terms of world problems, of national problems, international problems, and so on. Forgetting or deliberately shutting our eyes to the fact that each one of us is the whole world. I am the world. You are the world. It is embodied in you, in me. And the world condition is the expression on the macroscopic scale of what holds good for each one of us individually on the microscopic scale. Now, this is an extremely important point to bear in mind. Because whether we do it consciously or whether we do it unconsciously, usually it is unconsciously, we always throw the blame upon the world. Even if the world, that world, happens to consist of no more than one human being. It was his fault. You see, this we have to be very careful of. I am the world. We have to accept this responsibility and realize that whatsoever is the world condition, politically, socially, economically, as it keeps on changing, is the result of what we ourselves are individually. So now, at the present time, as you all know, the world condition is deteriorating very rapidly. The rise of violence, particularly. The loss of morality in every sphere. The world's moral backbone is broken in many pieces. The uncertainty, the way evil is almost supported. People say, oh, you're not with it. This is how the world is at present. Yes, of course, this is how the world is at present. But if you have fallen into a cesspool, do you get out and say, this is how I am at present and stay like that, or do you clean yourself? The world actually is a real stinking mess at present, and no mistake about it. And I, the individual, am responsible for it, and no mistake about that either. Let us be perfectly clear about this, and have no illusions whatsoever. Now, remember what we started with. The source and the goal are one. If the mess in the becoming process is to be made clean, start from the goal. Why start from the goal and why not from the source? The source undergoes the becoming process in order that, as far as we are concerned, the state of ignorance may be transformed into the state of enlightenment. And without that kind of knowledge at our command, nothing can be done. For the very simple reason that it is that kind of knowledge, this religious knowledge, this release of enlightenment and realization of transcendence, which is the only healing power in the world. You cannot heal any disease at its own level. It always has to come from a transcendent depth. If the body is sick, you cannot cure the sickness by another sickness. People think that they can, but they are mistaken. You can cure a sickness only from something which utterly transcends the sickness. Then it is set right. It is like solving a problem in mathematics. If you have the key equation to it, then all problems of that nature are solved by using that key equation. See? So transcendence is the key to it all. So now we start with the vision of transcendence, which cannot be laid down, remember. If anyone says to you that, transcendence is this, this and that, and God wishes this, this and that, and it's all blueprinted, tell him, have a good rest, my friend, and be quiet. It cannot be laid down. The vision of transcendence means that because one has this sense of transcendence in one, one is open-minded all the time, unresisting, looks and listens as if afresh every moment of his life, as if totally new. In other words, our concepts never interfere with the immediate percept. The immediate perceiving is the living experience. The concept has become a fossil. It is extracted out of thousands of percepts, as we all know. The concept will merely be able to name the percept. If you are looking at a particular situation and you'll say, that is a political matter, but I am not involved in politics, and that's that. So the concept merely names the situation for us. The concept structures percepts. So the concepts have their place. But our concepts have a peculiar inhibiting influence upon us. And they tend to push aside the actual living experience in the now, which is the actual perceiving now. And therefore, we cannot have quite the right relationship with the perception. So, out with all concepts of transcendence. The sense of transcendence simply means that there is that in us which thrills in response to that which is beyond us, as we are. And transcendence will everlastingly be beyond us. Every aspect of transcendence which has become us, as it does in the process of enlightenment, doesn't mean that transcendence becomes exhausted at some point. That is a time measure. But transcendence is infinite, eternal, timeless, unconditioned. Therefore, the fullness is everlastingly the fullness. If we have the sense of transcendence, then there is that in us which responds. And if we are able to keep our concepts in their right place, then the immediate perceiving will be of such a nature, the ordinary sense perceiving, with our eyes and our ears and so forth, will be of such a nature that we shall know what to do in the immediate now. This is very, very important. It is only then that we are truly alive in the human sense. It is the human being alone who can do this and be free of the restrictive influence of his conditioning and all that has enclosed his mind with fixed ideas and doctrines and dogmas. This, what the Buddha used to call the unconditioned freedom of mind. Now, back we come then to this something in us which has to be dealt with, the psyche. Because out of the psyche come all those forces which influence our own life, and because they influence our own life and make our own situation, they are also contributive to the world's situation. The healing of the world can never be done in terms of systems, of formulae, of plans, and so on, all of which emerge out of the worldly level with worldly values animating them. It can never be done that way. And in this sense, by worldly values, I include the laid down, conventional, orthodox religious values and ideas. They are no use at all. It can only be done through letting the unknown constantly function through us. You have only to study history to see how the unforeseen and the unexpected have played the paramount part in the history of nations and in our own lives too. Look back into your own lives and see how often the unexpected thing happened. And we say, oh, it just happened by chance, you know, luck or something, we say. And so and so happened, and then all the rest came out of it. Well, isn't that exactly how it happens? The unknown has the trump card in its hand. All of us, perhaps, at least I imagine all of us, there are no babies here, are there, have fallen in love, as we call it. Was it an intelligently planned out affair? Not a bit of it. Or was it an intellectually planned out affair? And then what happened? Misery on the grand scale. It is the unknown, the unexpected, and the unforeseen which plays the paramount part in our lives. And it is the transcendent which is the unexpected and the unforeseen. If we are in tune with that, then everything else happens in the right way. How then do we deal with our own situation, with the world's situation? How can we be open-minded in the true sense of the term? The fundamental necessity is purity. The silas, the moralities. People argue, ideas of morality change. Perfectly true. Ideas change. But do absolute moral values change? Does kindness ever change in such a way that it becomes identical with cruelty? Does love ever change in such a way that it becomes identical with hate? Or truth, that it becomes identical with falsehood? So out and away with the stupidity of the world, which doesn't understand the real meaning of change, which is change in terms of growth, of development and coming to fruition, instead of going the way of destruction. So never mind the changing fashions of the world, the ideas of morality changing. Morality is morality, simple fact. And we have to stand by it and see the fact for ourselves. That is extremely important. How do we bring about that change, which will enable us to become more and more open-minded? There, of course, the key word is mindfulness. It is the supreme word in the religious life. Mindfulness. To be observant. And we are observant, first and foremost, we have to be observant with our senses, remember. Because to be observant means to be aware of every single stimulus that comes to us or arises within us in consequence of memory or some internal mental condition. We have to use our senses. All the time. But do we use our senses all the time? We think we see something, but the concept has immediately dismissed it. Oh, that's an oak tree. No, but it happens that I'm looking at the oak tree. Am I really looking at it? And if I'm not really looking at it, am I having a right relationship with it? Leave aside the tree. We are concerned most, in greatest degree, with other people around us. When two people meet, when you and I meet, do we really meet? Do we really see each other? Or do we just have a swift judgment? Oh, he's tall, he looks a strong-minded person, or, well, he's a funny old chap with a nose which is bent inside out, or something like that. And dismiss the person. No, look. And if I really look, what happens? The most important thing that happens is that my self-consciousness is gone. I'm no longer conscious of myself as I am looking at you. There is a looking. There is a whole and a complete looking. And in that whole and complete looking, a whole relationship is immediately established, and it is alive. It is not established in the sense of a fixed relationship. It is a living relationship. This is the important point. If we don't have that whole living relationship with oneself, self-consciousness clean out of it, then we are in for difficulties and trouble and complications. Complications always set in. Now, this must be understood and put into practice, not only in relationship to people around us, but in relationship with everything around us throughout the day. Consider, when you walk into your room. You just walk into the room, you know that this is your bedroom or your dining room or whatever it is. But do you, the living being, really walk into the room which is alive? It is speechless, it is unmoving, but it is alive. Every single molecule of the stuff that makes that room is in vibration, very much alive, and it will outlast your life. Who is more alive? You or the room? Isn't that so? It's the same with events. When we go on a journey, oh, there's a bus, let's catch it. But be awake to the fact, here is this bus into which I'm getting. And if you're really alive to that fact, you will be in right relationship with that bus. Have you ever tried this, to be awake in this manner? You never have you? We do things automatically, mechanically. In other words, although we are the most alive creatures on this planet, we deliberately behave as if we were more than half dead anyway. We are not awake, we are not alive. We are too full of I am, this self-conceit, conceit in the sense of a fanciful notion. Not in the sense of pride, in the sense of a fanciful notion. We are too much caught up in it. And we are too much self-concerned with our particular problems, which we want to bring to a satisfactory conclusion in according to our particular desires. And this is where we fall down. The world is not concerned with our desires. Life is not concerned with our desires. Only we are, each one of us individually. Three million years we've lived on the globe. Or maybe more, maybe less. Never mind the actual number. Let's say 3 million, roughly. 2.5 million years ago, what did my ancestor desire? Do I know anything about it? Who cares about his desires? He was born, he lived, he died. I was born, I am living, I shall die. You think that the world process cares about my desires? The human race, supposing we live, succeed in living as long as the dear old dinosaurs, 150 million years, and nature will say, that's not a very good experiment. Psh, finished. Out. Just like that, you and I. Immortal souls and unimmortal souls alike. Let's have no illusions about it all. So, make real living right relationships in the here and now all the time with everything that we have to go through during the day. This is the deep meaning of living the religious life. Because whichever derivation you like with regard to the word religion, religare or religere, you look up your Latin dictionaries and you will find out for yourselves. Whichever derivation we like to make, religiousness means the transcending of the narrow, self-enclosed existence that we have, and a putting ourselves into tune and harmony with the whole, with transcendence. Now, mindfulness then, of an intense sort all through the day, is an essential for the religious life. And it is this which transforms the psyche. In this transformation process, what will happen? Your image will disappear altogether. The real living you will come into his own. The false concept we have of ourselves, the image we make of ourselves, the thing we call personality and mistake for the true person, which we are, that personality will go out altogether. That personality is the persona, the mask. The other person, the reality that we are, is the person in the grand meaning of the term. We have often talked about this, how in way back in the Upanishads, the great teachers taught the meaning of the word person. He in whom all evil-mindedness is burnt out. Sarvam papmanam. All evil-mindedness. And the word, you know, Sanskrit word is Purusha, and it has the root ush, meaning to burn out. And all evil-mindedness is burnt out. If we want to manufacture an absurd English word, is ushed out of us. That is the meaning of the person. Then that person comes into his own whilst we are alive here. This means that the psyche has undergone a tremendous transformation. At present, our psyches are filled with all sorts of clutter. Beliefs, ideas, conceptions, to which we cling. Beliefs, ideas, conceptions are necessary. We never can be without them. A Buddha or whoever, a Jesus or a Krishnamurti or anybody, a perfected holy one, whoever he is never empty of ideas, conceptions, which emerge in the living process from moment to moment. But those people never cling to them. This is the difference. They are passing thought forms. They correspond mentally to our breathing, the out-breath. We breathe in, we utilize that, and we breathe out. And when we breathe out, some of the material inside us is breathed out. So those ideas and beliefs are expressions out of the minds of those who are fully awake. And when we have come to the stage where such expressions come into being, and they go out of the mind, they are not clung to by the perfected one, then the mind is transparent. It is utterly pure. It is utterly clean. And you will find that all desirefulness, all desirousness is completely out. There is no such thing as a personal desire. There is no such thing as self-consciousness which separates us from anybody. Now, when that is the case, what happens with regard both to our external, our personal lives, as well as to the world life? Our personal life undergoes an extraordinary change in its pattern. The pattern which is terrible, which is ugly, which is full of hurt and darkness, evil, trouble, all that undergoes a change. It becomes a naturally harmonious pattern. Harmonious not in accord with my intellectual conceptions now. I am not the designer of that pattern. That pattern is designed by transcendence. This is what we forget. We always want to impose our ideas of what our lives ought to be upon what transcendence intends for us. But transcendence never imposes its intention. This is the marvel of transcendence. The omnipotent never exercises its potency. It's not necessary. 20 little puppies may yap at a lion, and he doesn't bother about them. When he feels weary enough and he gives a little growl, off scamper the puppies. And that's that. So you see, something like this means the living of the religious life with respect to ourselves. The pattern will alter, and as our own pattern alters, it makes its impress upon the world condition through the psyche. Not through the psyche essentially. Everything else is secondary to that. The world psyche, being what it is, constantly affects us. We cannot deal with the world psyche directly at its own level. But insofar as each one of us can purify his own psyche, empty it utterly, make it transparent, then transcendence comes into play. You become the center for transcendent activity, and you never know how it is working. You never can know. People will say, oh, but then this is just a fanciful idea of yours. Simply because you've been defeated by life, therefore you take refuge in transcendence. Nothing of the sort. This is a mistaken conception altogether. The trust in transcendence can never arise out of a retreat from life. Never. It is due to the fact that you are completely in tune with life, because you are utterly harmonized within yourself, you're selfless. And it is this which affects the world psyche and releases forces which somehow or other work through human beings, wheresoever they are ready to respond to such influences, and begins to change their life. And this is the only way in which any one individual can effectively change the state of the world, by himself being transformed. Now, this is not easy. What is the main reason why it is not easy? Apart from the fact that we haven't got such remarkable capacity. We are so tied up at this moment with all our different desires and ambitions and so forth, which have been responsible in part, not entirely. No one individual is wholly responsible for all that is there. So many others are also co-responsible with him. You see? We are so tied up with our own conditions that to keep one's eyes fixed upon this vision of transcendence is almost impossible for us poor mortals. But this is what we have to try to do. This is the deep meaning of yoga. So many of you are interested in yoga. And you know one of the elements composing yoga? It's named dharana. We have the moralities and the religious observances, then we have the postures and the breathing, then we have the pratyahara, which is not too well translated by saying withdrawal of the senses from the objects of sense. What it really means is using your senses rightly so that you experience neither attachment nor aversion through the use of the senses. That is pratyahara, that is the real withdrawal. And then dharana. Dharana, the upholding. The upholding of the eternal order of things. So you see, when the mind is free, pure, clean, empty, then you can begin to uphold the eternal order of things. You know what the Buddha said to Vassakara, a Brahmin who was the chief minister of the kingdom of Magadha when Ajatasattu was king. Ajatasattu decided to wage war against the Vajjayans, a powerful group of people. And the Buddha said, as long as the Vajjayans observe all that, I'm just condensing it very, very much. He said quite a lot. As long as the Vajjayans continue to observe all that is observed, all that has to be observed as a people, the Vajjayans will continue to flourish and they will not be destroyed. The historical fact was that Ajatasattu did triumph against them. Because the Vajjayans as a whole people could not live up to that level. But the significance of that event is just this, that at the root of it all is the observance of the moralities. And it is that alone which leads to the purification of one's own psyche. And the purification of the psyche produces the open-mindedness and that clarity of vision which is essential for bringing individual life to fruition. And insofar as individual life comes to its proper fruition, enlightenment, purity, peace, wisdom, the world's life is influenced thereby. And in this, the psyche holds the central point.